I'm Laura.
And I'm Georgiana.
And this is De Canterbury Tales. Hello.
Hello. How are y'all today?
I am doing great. How are you?
I am good. I just went to an open house for a house I can't afford. But we dream, don't we?
You're going to see how the other half lives.
Yeah, I love going to open houses. I don't know about y'all, but I get ideas. I just take little pieces from other people's homes, things I like, things I don't like, things that I can bring into my house, ideas for the next one. So, yeah, I love it.
Anyway, welcome to De Canterbury Tales, a book club with beverages.
And talking about open houses. I'm Georgiana.
I'm Laura. Welcome. This is our May episode that we are putting out late because life happens.
Life sure does happen. And I've been traveling a lot. I think I've spent like one weekend in Charleston in the month of May. So I'm part to blame on why this is so late, because I went to Nashville twice. I went to the mountains in North Carolina, which was great. I think that's all the traveling I did, but it feels like a lot.
I went to Nashville and my airport fiasco is now viral on Instagram. But, you know, that was enough for me for May. You know, I'm also still in treatment. So, you know, got to be home Monday through Friday. So I really only have weekends.
But I'm proud of you. You didn't drink in the airport debacle.
Whew. Y'all, I was trapped for over 16 hours in the Nashville airport and did not get a drink. And I was less than 30 days sober, trapped in an airport. There is only by the grace of God, y'all. Like, he granted me serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Like, yeah. It was so tough. But so happy that, you know, we got out of there and made it home. So
yes,
it was a journey.
And our reason for being in Nashville is really the other thing that this podcast is about.
Taylor Swift.
We love her so much.
So much. And we went together. And so if you follow us on Instagram, we posted some pictures of us at the Eras Tour in Nashville. We went to night 2. Which was not the rainy night. The rainy night was night 3, and we had so much fun.
And her pop-up songs that she did were really good. We got 15 and Out of the Woods. So
that was a good one.
That's a good one. I think the only night so far that I've seen that may beat it was the night that she just did. I think it was in Foxborough. No, it wasn't in Foxborough that she did it, but I don't think. But it was Maroon and Getaway Car.
Oh.
And that's a really good night.
Really, really jealous of that.
Yeah. So I'm like really trying to stop myself from going to another show.
I know. I really want to go see it again. It's bad.
I know. Really bad. Didn't I send you the ones in Mexico?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And the tickets are like $250. Why am I echoing?
You're not echoing to me.
Oh, okay. But onward.
Anyway, outside of traveling, what else have you been up to?
Working. That's really it. Traveling and working. Traveling for work. I did the application process, like the application itself for the program, and I'm redoing all of the handbooks. So a lot of just clerical marketing, and I am in the midst of organizing our storage closet at work.
Exciting. And
it's truly thrilling, but I need to order some more bins. So that's priority number one tomorrow. I know y'all really care about that.
I do.
But I'll take a picture of it and then y'all will get, I should have done it before.
Have you noticed anything different?
Yeah, it looks really good. You did organize.
I'm pointing for y'all can't see us. This is a podcast. I'm pointing in the corner of my room where I finally bought, purchased, assembled a bookshelf. And so all of my books are beautiful on a bookshelf. And it is, I could cry. It's been like that. All of my books have been just on the floor in a pile, like a dragon horde.
I also am, okay, this is another thing. I did not buy a single book in the month of April. Very proud of myself. But I went crazy in May. And my TBR list, my poor little cart is about to fall over.
Oh no.
There, I had to use the top shelf now too. It's bad. I think my TBR list is probably like 60 books deep now. Maybe not that much, 50. Yeah.
Man.
And we just got it sent an ARC yesterday. And I was like, I didn't order a book.
I know. I was like, uh-oh, am I in trouble? And I was like, oh, just kidding. This is a gift.
Yeah. I was like, Alex, I swear I didn't buy a book. I swear. And I was like, it was free.
Oh no.
But that doesn't mean that it's not about to topple over. So.
Oh yeah. So anyway, what have you been reading, watching, listening to?
Well, I am currently reading The Spare Room by Andy Bartz. It's not out yet, y'all, but we feel really cool. And maybe we'll just spoil this right now. This is our June book.
Hooray! The Spare Room by Andrea Bartz.
And so we've got Andy back on the show. Very excited about that, to get to talk to her. Again, it's about a year since we last spoke with her. So I'm kind of just really excited to catch up and see what she's been doing. But good so far. Enjoying it. We'll obviously save thoughts about that book for next month. This month. And then
excellent.
Watching Peaky Blinders.
Okay.
I am deep into Peaky Blinders. We are in season 5 and yeah, powering through that. I also started The Last Thing He Told Me on Apple. And then I finished Ted Lasso. Such a good show. I'm very sad that it is over. I've been really, no podcasts, but I've been on the shuffle. You know, when you just go to songs and hit shuffle and
Would you have a very extensive personal library? Whereas like I use Amazon Music. I don't own any of the music I listen to. I just stream.
Yeah. I have a bit of a library, a bit of a discography. And so it's kind of fun going back and being like, oh yeah, that was a really good song. Loved that. And I'm going to the beach. So I'm creating a beach playlist.
When are you going?
I leave on Friday.
Are you going to Orange Beach?
No, I'm going to Amelia Island.
Dang it. I'm going to Orange Beach.
No, I'm going to be in Amelia Island. Shout out to Tara. She is going to be in Orlando for a conference, and she and I go on a trip every year. And since we've already been to the Harry Styles concert, and the Niall Horan concert isn't for another year. So we had to do a non-concert, and it has to be a One Direction concert. Doesn't count.
That's the rule.
One Direction member concert. So she was like, well, if I'm already on your side of the continent, I will rent a car and we'll go to the beach. And I was like, cool.
Nice.
So
nice.
Now that y'all know, what are you reading, watching, and listening to?
So my reading has been more listening, since I'm in the car a lot more, driving all over town every single day, to therapy. And so I have been downloading a lot of audiobooks. So I books that I have read, I've read The Club by Ellery Lloyd and The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober by Catherine Gray, which I really enjoyed. I listened to Atomic Habits by James Clear, The Untethered Soul by Michael Allen Singer, Recovery by Russell Brand, Over the Top by Jonathan Van Ness, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck by Mark Manson. Wait, there's more that aren't written in my book. I've been on a Queer Eye kick. I've just been watching Queer Eye.
I haven't finished the new season, but I'm in it.
I listened to Over the Top, Jonathan Van Ness, Karamo by Karamo Brown, Naturally Tan by Tan France, and Queer Eye by the entire Queer Eye cast. And then I'm currently listening to Jonathan Van Ness's second book, Love That Story, and I'm almost done. I have 14 minutes left. Wow. So I literally have now listened, because they narrate all their own books, so I've listened to every single book that anyone has put out from the Queer Eye cast. It's comforting, and I also really love it. Karamo, and I actually like Karamo's book the most. It is quite a good listen. So if you're looking for something to listen to on Audible, highly recommend.
He's got a great voice too.
He really does. And
I'd put him up there with like David Attenborough and Morgan Freeman as like people I would just like let be the voice of everything in my mind.
Yeah.
Karamo Brown narrating.
Huh. He has a really, really interesting story. Just about his life. So highly recommend Karamo by Karamo Brown and Naturally Tan by Tan France. And I like JVN. 6 hours of his voice can be a little much. Yes, queen. Like, I love him, but I have to listen to him in small doses because sometimes I'm just like, oh, okay. But both of his books are really good.
You're like, I know I'm a queen, okay?
I know. But it's funny and I enjoy listening to him. So that's good. So that's reading and listening. Watching, I finished the most recent season of The Mandalorian. Nice. Which is very good. I went and saw the new Spider-Man movie that just came out, Across the Spider-Verse. And just so everyone knows, this is not a spoiler. I didn't know. It's a part one. So it's a part one, which means the story that starts in this movie does not end. There's not an ending. Okay. It is a true cliffhanger. The next movie doesn't come out till next year.
She's visibly upset, y'all.
I didn't know it was a part one. So like in the theater, I was like, all right, we've got, you know, I give it another 40 minutes. So this is a really long movie. And I was like, I have it another 40 minutes and we are about to wrap this storyline up. And then it was like, fade to black, Spider-Man will return in a whatever Spider-Verse part two. And I was like, what? I was like, you've got to be kidding me. So, and it's one hell of a cliffhanger. So
cool. I went and saw The Little Mermaid, which was very good. It was good.
I've heard very good things.
Yeah. Halle Bailey did a really good job. Yeah.
I'm so happy to hear that. I've heard very good things. So I'm excited about that. I rewatched the animated Little Mermaid with Ferris. He had never seen it.
Oh, it's so good.
I don't remember what comment he made. He was kind of like, oh, he was like, I don't know how he's like in love with her. He just spent a whole day with her and all she did was like blankly stare at him and respond and like nod her head. Like, how are you carrying on conversations with her? You're just talking at her and she's just like moving her arms around and nodding. He was like, I would just been like, wow, what a weirdo. She's like amazed by like puppets and horses. she's a little confused.
You know, I mean, if you think about it that way, he's not wrong, but don't kill the joy, man.
That's what I was like, Ferris, you're just gonna have to go with it. But it was so funny. He was like, I would have been like, she's so weird. Like, why did she just put a fork in her hair? Like, she's so strange. But yeah, so we watched that, and what else? been binging Queer Eye. And that's kind of it. I spend 3 hours a day, almost every single day in therapy. So I, you know, y'all, I'm not doing a lot. I'm digging a lot in my brain. So it's been a journey. I'm 47 days sober as of this taping. So
nice.
Huzzah, well, everyone.
I'm proud of you, and my therapist is proud of you.
Thank you. That's what I really need in my life.
Yeah. Somebody else's therapist being proud of you.
You know what? I'll take it. I will take it.
Take that one.
You know, as an addict, I am, I'll take any form of compliment. Really. Anyway, shall we dig in? This month's book is
Counterfeit by Kirsten Chen.
And Georgiana was my hero. I had a corporate visit for work and was not able to actually make the appointment that we made with her to interview her. So Georgiana got to interview her, and I cannot wait to hear it. I'm so excited for that. And yeah, so thank you for coming on the show, and thank you for carrying us, Georgiana.
Yeah, no, she was so great to talk to. I think I'm going to read this New York Times article so that you can kind of get set in the scene before I talk to her. This is a really good article called Real or Fake in this novel.
Do you want to cover our wines first?
No, we can do this and then we'll do that.
Okay.
So this article is from the New York Times. It's titled Real or Fake in this novel. It's not just a question of handbags. And it's by Camille Perry. At face value, Kirsten Chen's new novel, Counterfeit, is easy to sum up. Ava Wong, a straight-laced Chinese-American lawyer, reconnects with her enigmatic college roommate, Winnie, and becomes entangled in a scheme that involves importing counterfeit luxury handbags. When trouble arises, Winnie disappears, leaving Ava to deal with the consequences. Seemingly, what you see is what you get. A con artist story, a pop feminist caper, a fashionable romp. Fun, pass the popcorn, except nothing in this novel is what it seems. Make no mistake, Counterfeit is an entertaining, luxurious read, but beneath its glitz and flash, there is also a shrewd deconstruction of the American dream and the myth of the model minority. The novel begins as a conciliatory first-person narrative. Ava is at mid-interrogation, speaking to a detective whose voice we never hear. It is a one-sided conversation, an apparent confession. Her defense leans upon her well-worn Asian stereotypes about hard work and family values. She attributes her current predicament to her innate sense of drive. What can I say, detective? You don't earn straight A's all your life without being uncommonly competitive and being raised in a culture fixated on image, reputation, and honor, which must be fought for and preserved at all costs. Ava blames her upbringing for her lack of agency in decision-making. It was easier and less risky to vanish into the image that my parents and the world had of the good Chinese American daughter. A reader can't be faulted for being swept up in Ava's narrative, for sympathizing with her plight, even rooting for her acquittal. Halfway through, one might assume this novel's most pressing question is whether Ava will get away with her misdeeds. This would be fine, but thankfully the second half of the book obliterates that assumption. Winnie's voice enters the story at the midpoint, shining a stark light on the eccentricity of the previous section. We're suddenly privy to someone's inner thoughts and feelings. Suddenly, we realize we've been fed a monologue. Quotation marks appear for the first time. Readers love a twist, and I won't spoil this one by revealing too much, but Chen is up to something innovative and subversive here. She uses the device to flip Asian and Asian American stereotypes inside out and upside down. She plays on biases, both conscious and unconscious. Now that more of the picture is colored in, we have to reevaluate Ava's pandering defense. It becomes a subversive act, a reclamation of power. She has played on this detective's and the reader's unconscious or conscious bias. She used stereotype to her advantage. If you haven't figured out by now, Ava and Winnie have an axe to grind. They are unruly and unapologetic, stopping at nothing to get what they want. In this way, they are quintessentially American with characteristically American dreams. This is Chen's real subject, if I dare use the word real anywhere near this novel. The American ideal is a life of material prosperity and comfort, but equal opportunity is insincere, feigned, counterfeit. So can we blame Ava for feeling entitled to, as Winnie puts it, a life of wealth and delight and adventure, a life she's been promised only she worked hard enough and followed the rules and never slipped up. Before Winnie reappeared into her life, Ava had obeyed the rules. She'd gone to the right schools, chosen the right career, married the right partner, formed the right family, and made enormous sacrifices in the process. Yet here she was, thoroughly miserable, horrified by the prospect that her entire existence had been built on lies. You can decide for yourself whether Counterfeit is a tale of genuine American gumption or not. Either way, you must grapple with the question, if the dream itself is a false promise, why not achieve it through fakery?
Nice.
A really good job, Camille. That's a really good article. And so Kirsten and I kind of talk about, we always spoil it. But you find that the narrative that Ava spins to the detective is in protection of what really happened. And she was much more complicit and active really is a better word, in the counterfeit business of handbags. And she's not as innocent as she seems in everything. And in the end, she leaves her husband, and she and Winnie and her baby live happily ever after.
And they start a second scheme.
Correct.
I'm obsessed with that. That they're just like, we'll lay low long enough.
So yeah, do that next hustle.
Wild. That's when I texted you and was like, this is our book. This is our book. It's so good. Like that twist when it comes up and all of a sudden you're reading in Winnie's perspective and you're just sitting there like, wait.
Mm-hmm. No, it's so true. The first part of the book, good, fine, enjoyed it. But when I got to that second part, to Winnie's section, that just game changer of the novel for me. It went from being like good to like, oh, very good.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And then you get like a whole facial reconstruction surgery for Winnie. Yep. And like just the whole thing is just wild.
It's insane. It's ridiculous, but
I love it.
Really good. And I'm so happy we got to speak with Kirsten. So I hope that y'all enjoy it.
Enjoy our interview.
Or my interview.
Georgiana's interview.
Well, welcome everybody. We are here with Kirsten Chen, the author of Counterfeit. And so how are you today? Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm doing great. Weather is warming up. That always makes me happy.
Yes.
I have a bit of a lingering cough. I have like all my water and stuff nearby, but just excuse me in advance if I do end up needing to cough. But other than that, I'm doing great.
Hey, you got your supplies. You're ready to go. It'll be good. Mm-hmm. And where are you recording from?
I live in New York City. Okay, I moved here in October, so not too long ago. I'm a new New Yorker. So far, it's been pretty good.
Yeah, I was going to say you're liking city life.
Oh, well, I moved from another city. So I was on the West Coast in San Francisco.
Okay. City to city,
but still, I don't think there's any city like New York. You know, I think just in terms of, at least in the US, in terms of scale and density and all of that. So it has been an adjustment, but, you know, it's a good place to be a writer. There's a vibrant literary scene. It's the center of publishing. And so in that respect, I think it was the smoothest move I could have asked for.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah. I wish I could be one of those people that lived in New York. I thought I could be one day. And then I visited enough times and saw my friends living there. And I was like, I could not hang in New York. It is a fun place to be. And if I was an author, I'd be like, yes, all over it. Just because I feel like the inspiration would just be everywhere you go.
Yeah, totally. I'm with you. And I think that it would have been overwhelming for me at maybe 25, you know, because I think there is just so much going on. You could go out every single night. There are parties every day, you know, you could go to a party every night if you wanted to, but because I'm 41, turning 42, like it's actually nice. Like, I don't have FOMO. I don't feel like I have to, you know, I know who I am. I know who my friends are. But yeah, as a younger person, I think it would be really, really exciting, but also a little overwhelming.
I could not agree more. My 31-year-old self is like, I'm good. I don't need to do that. Like one activity every 2 weeks. I'm like, that's enough plans for me. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Well, we always like to start out our interviews with a little horn toot. So Counterfeit was a instant New York Times bestseller and Ariza's book club pick. So first of all, congratulations on
that.
Thank
you.
And so tell us kind of about that moment, those calls and that process. How did it feel? Take us back a little bit. And then obviously, did you get to meet Reese?
I'll just get that out of the way. I have not met Reese.
Okay.
I have not met her, but I'm holding out hope that it will still happen. She does run these like pop-ups during the holidays at bookstores, and she has various events for the Reese's Book Club. And so I feel like our paths will cross.
I like that.
But I have not met her in person. It was incredible finding out about the Reese's Book Club pick. I mean, I'm sure your readers know this. It's one of the single biggest honors that an author could receive. I mean, it's one of the things that really moves the needle in terms of sales. You know, maybe the single biggest thing that moves the needle in terms of sales. So it was a tremendous, tremendous honor. I remember that my editor called me like close, kind of around the holidays. Kind of a strange time in the morning. She never calls me without scheduling a meeting. So I thought she had butt dialed me. And so I just declined the call. And she immediately sent me an email and was like, Kirsten, call me back right now. And so I called her and she yells into the phone, you're the Reese's Book Club pick. And I run to the other room. My husband happens to be working from home. I run to the other room and I yell, we're the Reese's Book Club pick, just as my editor is yelling, you cannot tell a single person until the book comes out. This has to be a secret. Like it's, you know, I mean, they're serious about that just because the reveal is such a huge thing every month. And so they don't want people leaking, you know, they don't want people knowing months in advance. So my husband and I kept it a secret. it was like winning the lottery, you know, quite honestly. And I've said this before in other interviews that it feels like something that happened to me and not something that I worked really hard to achieve. And so it's a kind of an odd thing to think about. And it's not that I'm not proud of my book, and I worked really hard on this book, and I'm proud of it. I think it's a good book, but I also know that thousands of other books could have been picked. For even just the month of June, 1,000 other books could have been picked. And for some reason it was mine. And so I'm so grateful for it, but I don't for a second pretend that there's something, you know, that it's like something that I worked for, if that makes sense.
Well, you wrote a really good book, so I completely understand why she picked you. But I mean, there is something just very compelling about the premise, especially if you're at all interested in popular culture, fashion, things like that, you're automatically hooked there. But we're going to get into this in a little bit because I was not expecting part two to be to explain what part one was. I was so confused. I was just like, whoa. And so it's like a little gift to you as you're reading the book is like, okay, I think that this is going to be one thing. And then all of a sudden you just take me in a different direction. Yep. So thank you for that. So I totally get why Reese was like, yeah, we're going to pick that one. And I did see on Instagram that you were wearing matching outfits.
Oh, so, that was completely by chance, really.
But that's how you know you're like fated to be friends and to meet in real life. Yes. It's like same taste.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'll take it. I agree.
Written in the stars or in the clothes, if you will. Yeah. So this book is surrounded around counterfeit luxury good industry. So how did you research that industry, get to know so much about it? And then how did that kind of impact your view on the fashion industry as a whole?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, the first thing I will say is that I am a lifelong lover of fashion. And so right out of college, I actually did a management training program at Gap Inc. I was became a merchandise planner at Banana Republic. I wanted to work in fashion. So that's something that I've always loved. And in fact, when I was coming up with the idea for this book, it really started as a joke. I was working on my last novel, which is a very different book. It's historical fiction. It's set in 1950s Southern China. And it's a very weighty story about a family that's torn apart by the political circumstances. And it's also a book that, as you can imagine, required a lot of research.
Yes, for sure.
And one day after like a particularly hard day, I turned to my husband and I said, you know, the next book I write is going to require zero research and it's going to have to be about the only thing I know about. And that's handbags, because I am an armchair expert on handbags. And I didn't think anything of it. I wasn't actually going to write a book about handbags, but a couple, weeks later, I came across an article in the Washington Post about this real life counterfeit handbag con artist who had come up with this perfect scheme and went on, undetected for, I don't remember how long, but for a really long time. And when I read that, I thought, oh, that belongs in a novel. You know, it's not a book about handbags. It's a book about a counterfeit handbag scheme. And so that's kind of when I started to take the idea seriously. And then, you know, the joke ended up being on me because it required a tremendous amount of research. You know, I didn't know anything about the counterfeit handbag industry.
So you don't do that as your side hustle?
No, it's not my side hustle. I don't buy counterfeit hand. You know, it was a very, very right. new field. And I ended up having to travel to Guangzhou in Southern China. I traveled to Hong Kong. I visited the markets. I used a contact to visit a legitimate handbag factory just to even learn how handbags are manufactured, because I had no idea what went into them. And then the other thing I did was I got to speak to an intellectual property lawyer who's based in Hong Kong, and her job is to protect the trademarks for these huge international brands. It's so interesting and so difficult, but that's her job. You know, like she works with like major international brands and tries to protect their copyright in China. And so she had such a great perspective. And I don't think I could have written the book without doing all that research, you know, because like it's one of these books that like really depends on a kind of insider quality to it. Like you want to believe that these narrators are experts and truly immersed in the business, and to get that level of expertise, like I had to learn it.
And I was just thinking about that as you were saying it, it could so go one off very quickly if you did not believe that they were invested and could do it. And I truly did. I was like, they are learning this. And when, you know, Ava was kind of playing dumb about a little bit of it, like I totally believed that she didn't get it. And then all of a sudden she does. So no, I knew from reading it, it was so much research to get to that level of comfortability to write that way. And so with that, you do write about some really big name designers. And so do you have a favorite bag? Hey, you've just like, oh, I love it. Do you own it? Do you want it? That sort of thing.
Yes. Oh, I have an extensive bag collection. Okay. I will say that one of my favorite bags is, it's not the fanciest bag, but when I was, my junior year in college, I, lived in Paris, and for my 21st birthday, I bought myself this Louis Vuitton handbag on the Champs-Élysées in
memory.
Paris.
Yeah.
And I still care. I mean, it's like this little, it's nothing like if you saw it, you would be like, oh, that, it's not so special except for the emotional value, I guess.
Absolutely.
And the memories that it holds. And I still carry it. I love it. Mm-hmm.
Hey, and you get transported back to that moment when you carry the bag, get some little 21 energy going.
Totally. And also like, I, Yeah. And I, you know, I love fashion because I just think it's so, well, I love the kind of play, the playfulness of it, but also the kind of aspirational quality, like the kind of the way that we like aspire to be our best selves. And I always, you know, like the fact that I chose that particular, you know, walked into the store, looked at all that, you know, chose that particular one. Like, I don't know, there's something very tender about it, I think.
No, I completely agree with you. And there's such a sentimentality about it. I got my minor in fashion merchandising.
Oh my gosh, you did.
Just because I loved fashion so much. I was like, if I'm going to go to college and I'm going to get a major that I'm going to use in life, but I want my minor to be something I'm really interested in, something I just think is really cool. And so just the business side of it, but then what clothes communicate about yourself, what you are putting out into the world, how you feel about yourself. Like, and I mean, Ava, like the moment she puts that bag on her arm, like she feels like a new person.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like, it's so much more than a bag.
Are you a handbag person then?
I am a shoe person more than a handbag person.
I feel like it's one or the other, right?
It is. It is. But I mean, I do have a couple of bags here or there that I've like purchased specifically, and every single time I wear them, I feel so good about myself. I have this a little Yves Saint Laurent bag that I got, and it's like the one that everybody else had.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's black, all black.
And I love that one.
Yep. So there's no, it can go with anything. I can dress it up with jeans. I can wear it with cocktail. I'm like, this bag, I put it on and I was like, even if I'm not feeling myself,
That's my favorite version of that bag. I know exactly what you're talking about. Did you ever work in fashion or did you just do that in school?
I did. I actually worked for Banana Republic as well. Yes. I know the
Love
gap.
It. Yes.
And then I worked for a boutique in New Orleans called Yvonne Le Fleur. And it's a 10,000 square foot store, European shopping experience, wedding dresses, ball gowns, custom made things. Mm. Ready to wear, accessories galore. And there were literally furs hanging from the ceiling.
Amazing.
And
amazing.
So that was my fashion time. And then I switched industries, but it was fun kind of getting to flex that for a little bit that I had no intention, but really loved it. So I guess we flipped to the plot a little bit because we've kind of like dusted over it. But
sure.
I specifically wanted to ask about Maria at the start because it seems like Maria kind of fills many roles for Ava. She's a friend. She's the nanny, obviously, but she kind of fills that motherly role that she's missing. And then her husband's gone all the time. So sometimes the husband role. And so she trusts her, cares about what she thinks. So how does Maria's reaction to Ava's actions as the novel progresses inform Ava's decisions and perceptions of herself?
Yeah, you know, nobody asks me about Maria.
She's my favorite.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me that you kind of zoomed. I love that you did because I worked really hard to make her a full character. Like I didn't want her to be this kind of side, you know, a kind of supporting, you know, I didn't want her in a supporting role and I didn't want her to be one dimensional. Yes, I think you're right. I mean, I think Ava, the way that I conceived of Ava, she is this person who is so used to being in control of her life. Mm-hmm. She's gone to all the right schools. She's always gotten straight A's. She marries the right person. She goes into the right industry. Like she just kind of ticks all the boxes. Right. And the one place where she can't control everything is motherhood. She can't control her kid. You know, and it's, you know, I myself, I'm not a parent, but all my friends who have children have told, and I have a nephew, and they've all told me that by the time your child is like a couple months old, they have a personality and like a will that is purely their own. Like, you know, you think like they're a baby, okay, but they're like completely a fully formed human being. Oh, yeah. And you can't impose your will on them. Do you have children?
I do not. Lara has a son, but I also have a nephew. So I'm like, I'm thinking about my little Kelly boy.
Exactly.
His stuff.
Exactly. And so I think like motherhood is the one place where Ava's falling short in her life, and she's really insecure about it. And I think that kind of makes her, draws her to Maria in a way that she maybe wouldn't be otherwise. And so I think that's one of the reasons Maria grows to play such a big role in her life. I also think that Ava is one of these like liberal, one of these like upper middle class liberal people who really wants to be the kind of person that is best friends with her nanny, you know, and thinks of her, you know, like it's kind of like all tied up into her perception of what she thinks is the right thing to do. And so much of this book is about how Ava's perhaps misconceptions of how she has to be lead her down this wrong path. And so, you know, Maria was a great place to explore a lot of those themes.
Mm-hmm. No, Maria was my favorite. I don't know how nobody has asked you about her, because I was just like, she was like the moral compass almost. Yeah. Like she's like, well, what would Maria think? I don't want Maria to know because I think that she's going to judge me in some way. And so, I mean, because Maria was okay with her not knowing how to be a mom, and she was there to help her through it. But she was like, I don't know. There was just a really good relationship there and balancing act for me.
Love it. Thank you.
Yep, of course. So moving into the other female lead along with Ava, Winnie. So we are told, or it is a big revelation, that the bulk of the narrative is a confession to a detective, not the truth of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. So how did that plot twist come about in your writing process? Because like I said earlier, I was not expecting that to be that.
We are going to try to avoid spoilers, right? Is that?
We spoil it.
Oh, we spoil. Okay.
We love spoiling.
Okay, great. So we'll just go ahead and talk about it. Yes. So initially, when in the very first draft of the book, I tried to write the entire book as a confessional from Ava's point of view. So Ava's talking to the detective and we understand something's not quite right. And I think from a craft perspective, I was really interested in exploring unreliable narrators. And a confessional is the kind of ideal format for that, because obviously when somebody is confessing to a detective, they're in trouble and their only motivation is to convince someone of their innocence. And so everything they're going to say is to serve that purpose. And so that has inherent, you know, there's a very clear reason for Ava's unreliability in that moment. It's mm-hmm. that she's trying to go free. And so I tried to do it entirely from her perspective and immediately saw it wasn't going to work, because there was no way to tease out the nuances of Ava's confession. Like I couldn't show when she was flat out lying, when she was actually telling the truth, when she's exaggerating a little bit. Like I couldn't show any of that because all we have is her perspective. And so that's when I knew, okay, I need to bring in Winnie's perspective. We need to get another voice. And I thought of Winnie's chapters as the story of record. Hers is kind of in traditional third, there's a traditional narrator. There are quotation marks in her section because she's not talking, you know, it's not a monologue. It's kind of told in a traditional, a quote unquote, traditional story format. Mm-hmm. Once I figured that out, that we needed the two points of view, it took an incredible amount of work to finesse when we were going to bring Winnie in. So at what point in the book are we going to switch points of view? Once we switch points of view, at what point are we going to reveal what is actually going on? That kind of thing. All of that took, I was rewriting that middle section. I must have rewritten it 15 times to just get to get the voice, to get the tone, to get the pacing exactly right, because I think it's such an important part of the book and it really has to land.
You wrote it well, because I was not expecting that to happen. And then that kind of like brings me to one of our other question is like, how do you decide and to separate what is true and what's not true?
Yeah.
Because Ava's telling the story to the detective. She's an unreliable narrator. And then, you know, Winnie is kind of the more first person traditional, but at the end of the day, it is her understanding of the situation as well. So in that sense, she could also be an unreliable narrator. So, you know, what who and what is the truth? Like, who can we trust in this book? Because
I mean, isn't that the question though? Because anytime a narrator is telling the story, they are blinded by their own perspective, mm-hmm. even if they're trying their very best to tell you the truth. And so that's how I distinguish them. Yes, in Winnie's sections, she is telling, it's her interpretation of events. It's still very much colored by her background, by where she grew up, by how she sees Ava, by the dynamics of their friendship. But she is, to the best of her knowledge, trying to tell the reader what happened, which is, I think, how a traditional narrator mostly works. With Ava, she's not trying to do that, right? She's trying to prove her innocence. That being said, I do think Ava is telling the truth a lot of the time. You know, the best liars use their real backgrounds to lie, right? That's why that's why it's effective. If you were just constantly making up fanciful things, you would get caught because it's too difficult to keep everything straight. And so whenever you see these, like, I don't know, con artists who have been successful for decades and decades, it's often because they're leaning on real parts of their history and, you know, inventing stories based on, a lot of them are rooted in fact. And so I think of that with Ava. You know, it's not that she invented her family. No, her relationship with her brother, her relationship with her dad, her relationship with her mom, all of that is true. But she knows how the detective looks at her, and she knows how to exaggerate the details of her life in order to get the detective's sympathy, right? So she's willing to use her mom's death to gain sympathy from the detective. It's not, but her mom did in fact die, and she was in fact sad. But it's an interesting part, you know, that in and
the of justification
itself,
of it.
Yes, and that in of itself is a telling detail, that she's willing to use that detail about her. You know, she's willing to use that terrible, tragic thing to gain her innocence, or to prove, or to kind of, you know, gain sympathy. So that's how I thought of it. You know, I thought of her, as very much the character she's portraying, except exaggerating particular details to gain sympathy.
And the parts that Winnie ends up talking about are probably the more true exaggerations of everything, not her exaggerations in the testimony.
Right. Wow. Exactly. It was complicated. It was hard to keep straight. You know, I was constantly kind of, okay, who is she? What is she trying to accomplish at this moment? You know, how do we do this? Yeah.
Because they have such distinct voices. And, you know, their stories, like, corroborate, essentially. They time up correctly, but each woman has a very distinct voice. And, you know, I mean, obviously, besides the sections, but you would know if they were side by side who was telling what story.
Yeah.
I've thought of
that a lot, because in so many ways they're foils, right? They're opposites. Mm-hmm. At least on the surface, Ava is, ticks all the boxes, does all the right things, rule abider. And then Winnie comes in and she's just this, like, I don't know, when you bull in a china shop or whatever, pick your metaphor. She's just bold, and she doesn't care what people think about her. And so in some ways they're kind of doppelgangers. In some ways, like, some people have described Winnie as like Ava's darkest thoughts, you know, like I had a reader who was like, at first I thought, like, Winnie was a figment of Ava's imagination, because Winnie was like Ava's kind of dark, you know, id or whatever, kind of like a Fight Club scenario. That's not how I envisioned it, but I do think of them as kind of, at least in the beginning, they are very much opposites, and that is what draws them together. And then we find out that, you know, maybe they're not as opposite as they seem, or that sometimes opposites, you go full circle and you're, you know, same again.
And, I'm just thinking about this, like, kind of how, for lack of a better word, self-righteous Ava was about being in the school and checking all the boxes and Winnie leaving. And so obviously she had to have somebody take the test for her.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would have imagined that she was the one taking the test.
Yeah.
And that's why she was, like, scared.
Yeah.
Not because she needed help, is that
she was the perfect
really mastermind of it all.
Yes, yes.
She just underestimated.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
No, that was really cool. And then, so kind of continuing that, did Winnie and Ava, because this is still a little unclear, did they become or remain friends between college and this narrative? Yeah. Or was it just, I'm walking in, this is what we're doing sort of situation?
Yeah, no, I mean, I see it as they basically fell out of touch. So Ava's pretty much telling the truth. The only detail she leaves out is that Winnie needs a green card recommendation to her. And so there is one moment when Winnie reaches out to Ava that Ava leaves out of it, obviously doesn't tell the detective that she helped her falsify information on her green card. But other than that, I think it's true. They fall out of touch. You know, Winnie goes back, all of that, those details, Winnie goes back to China and has to graduate from college there. Yeah. I think, you know, she comes out of the blue to find Ava, and the reasons that Winnie comes out of the blue to find Ava, I think, are all true as well.
Okay, cool. I just, you know, with who's, which one's the unreliable narrator, which one is, it's like, which, so what narrative kind of won out, but that makes sense that if Winnie's kind of the one we trust, that there's some truth in that.
Yep.
So now we kind of switch gears to some fun questions as well. So we did some light Instagram stalking. It's casual. Oh, don't worry about
it.
And we saw that you were a yoga enthusiast. And so Laura is actually in the process of getting her certification. So what do you love most about the practice? And do you have any tips for Laura?
Laura probably needs to give me tips if she's the one getting certified. What do I love most about the practice? I mean, it would be no exaggeration to say that yoga has taught me more about writing than any, maybe even more than graduate school, to be honest. No knock on my graduate school, because I loved getting an MFA. It was a great, great program. But the kind of yoga that I do is, it's daily, it's very routine, and it's self-guided. So you go to the studio, and instead of a teacher standing in the front of the room telling you what to do, is everybody comes in at, you know, between the hours of, I don't know, 6 a.m. and 10 a.m. and does their practice, does a series of poses. And when you've mastered a pose, the teacher gives you a new pose. And so you just kind of keep adding on to the series of poses. It's a really kind of different format. But the idea is that you come in and you do the same thing every day. And it really appeals to people who don't get easily bored. And it's interesting because it gets you thinking, well, firstly, you can track the way that you feel every day, because you're doing the exact same thing. And I've been doing the exact same thing for, at this point, 15 years near daily. And it has taught me that you show up and you meet your body where it is, to use a kind of yoga cliche. Whether you're hungover from the night before or you didn't get enough sleep, you just show up and do what you can do. And that's kind of how I approach writing. I think of it as a daily practice. I think of it as showing up every day, sitting down at my computer. Some days you don't feel inspired. Most days, I would say 90% of the time, you aren't like, oh, I can't wait to write. 90% of the time I sit down and I think, this is my job. I'm going to write. I actually use a word count. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to write 1,000 words today. They don't have to be the most brilliant 1,000 words I've ever written, but I'm going to do it. And I really came to that from yoga. You know, before that, I would, in grad school, I had deadlines. And so that, you know, when the deadline came, I would stay up all night and try to finish a story, or I would be super motivated and super inspired because the deadline was approaching. But once you're out of school, there are no deadlines. Nobody really cares if you take a month or 6 months, or, you know, every deadline is my own. Mm-hmm. And so that's what yoga has taught me, is to kind of show up, do the work, and trust that if you show up enough days in a row, you write a thousand words every day, after a number of days, you will have a novel at the end of that.
I was not expecting that answer. I'm like, that is so cool, because you're right. It's both accountability, it's habit building and habit formation, and just allowing yourself to get better and to succeed.
I mean, I think of it a lot like lifting weights or like playing scales. If you're a musician, right? Like, the scales itself are not that interesting, but if you do it enough, you can play a concerto or whatever it is, you know?
No, that's a pep talk we all need to be told. Just keep doing it, guys. You will get better one day, or it will get done one day.
Yeah, I think so. I think if you show up with intention, you know, like you're not just like sleeping through it.
Right.
If you show up with intention, you will get better. Like that's just how it works. Yeah.
Well, there's the tip, Laura. Show up and you will get better. So this is our favorite question we ask everybody that we interview. What's your go-to book? The one with notes in the margins, tattered pages, maybe a wine stain. And then what is your go-to beverage?
Oh, I do love that this is a wine podcast. I was going to ask what you're going to pair this, pair me with. What is my go-to book? I'm very, very careful about notes in the margin because I'm one of those people that likes to keep my books like very pristine.
Right there with you.
But gosh, I mean, a book that I've probably reread the most is probably The Great Gatsby.
Love.
I love it too. But I also think it is just incredibly well constructed. And so, you know, with different books that I'm writing, I'm looking for certain things. And so I'll seek out the books that are that solve that problem. But kind of overall, if I'm trying to, I don't know, like one time I had to be on a panel on how to write the middle of novel, how to get through the muddy middle of a novel. And anytime I have to do something like that, I look at The Great Gatsby because I think like that's a really good example. It's short enough that you can hold it all in your head. And it really holds up. You know, sometimes there are books that you, like I first read that book in high school and loved it from the start. And sometimes more often than not, you go back to those books and you're like, oh, it's a young person's book. Yeah. And The Great Gatsby so far have not had that experience.
Yep.
Oh, go-to beverage.
Go-to beverage. Yes.
I would say if money were no object,
we love
my
that.
Go-to wine would be a red or white Burgundy. That is kind of like my, I mean, partly is because I went on vacation there with one of my closest friends in 2009-ish and we like hiked through Burgundy. So I have very fond memories of Burgundy.
Right.
I also think it just really suits my palate. Like I don't like anything very, very bold, very, you know, like I'm not like a, I don't know, Cabernet person. Like I like things like quieter,
a little more subtle,
drier, minerally, all that stuff, all the stuff that Burgundy, red and white Burgundies are. So that would be my go-to wine if money were no object.
Well, then to answer your question, you were wondering what we were going to pick. We were going to wait to see what your type was to pick for the wine.
Oh.
And, but we are going to pair with this shop that I found here in Charleston, and it's a non-alcoholic spirit store.
Oh, I love it.
So it's wines, beers, champagnes, all sorts of cocktails, like counterfeit cocktail.
That's so smart. What is the store called? Because we have
Sachet is what it's called here.
We have one in New York that I love. I mean, I drink a lot of non-alcoholic spirits actually. So yes, love it.
It's cool to bring in, you know, and I was talking to the owner and she was like, a lot of our customers drink. It's not that they don't drink. It's just sometimes maybe they don't need to drink or want to drink. And so this provides another option to give you that feeling, that vibe. And so we were like, well, counterfeit baths, counterfeit cocktails.
That's so smart. So what is your wine background?
So I just like wine and Laura just likes wine. Neither of us are trained in anything. I did work at a fruit wine bar for a summer.
Oh, that's training.
I can pour a glass. I can make a wine smoothie.
Love
really
it.
Interesting. But mostly the podcast came out of Laura and I both liking books and both liking wine and realizing that both can sometimes feel unattainable, you know, that reading, it's sometimes like if you don't, I guess, feel like you understand the book or could talk about it, or maybe your taste doesn't match with people, things like that. But letting you know that there is a book for you everywhere, like reading is accessible. And same with wine. Like, you know, if all the money in the world, like you could buy the Burgundy wine, like you know that that's your wine. But at the end of the day, with that money comes that clout, that air about wine. And so trying to learn more about wine and the industry so that we can make it more accessible. And so all of our wines are under $25 that we pick. And So yeah, just making reading and wine accessible to people because it should be fun. It shouldn't be
intimidating.
Shouldn't be difficult.
Yeah, I love it. That's such a great, I mean, it's such a great idea. And I'm glad you came up with it.
Well, thank you. We appreciate it. We have a lot of fun and, you know, we feel so lucky. We started it and we did not think that authors were going to want to come talk to us. Winemakers going to want to come talk to us. So y'all are the ones that like really propel us to keep going, that y'all keep writing awesome books and then keep telling us about them because we're like, oh my God, this is so cool.
No, I've listened to a couple of your episodes and they're great. So I was happy to do this. Yeah.
Thank you. See, hear it. You heard it first, guys. So you should listen too. So to kind of wrap up, also before I wrap up, my dog's name are Gatsby and Daisy.
Oh my gosh.
So I love it. I'm a Gatsby fan myself.
You're a super fan.
I am. But so what's next? And where can our listeners find you? Plug away.
Oh, sure. Gosh, what's next? I'm in the thick of another novel. Yes. It's a long, so I'm kind of I'm a kind of 4 to 5 years per book kind of person. Like that's how long it takes me. So this is just the early stages. I'm working on a novel. It's set in Silicon Valley. It's called Tech Wives. And the two main characters are loosely based on Priscilla Chan Zuckerberg and Mackenzie Bezos. And it imagines that they are best friends kind of navigating this life married to these tech titans. So that's what I'm working on now. We have a counterfeit TV series that is kind of slowly, I'm not even sure if I should talk about this publicly. Like I said it, and then I was like, you shouldn't say that. Then we're just kind of slow. You can edit.
Do what you want
with this. It's slowly kind of progressing, let's say.
Okay.
Maybe by the time it airs, there will be an official announcement, in which case, you know, when will this air?
Sometime in April, sometime in May. Whew, I'm losing my mind. Yeah, sometime in May. Okay, so it's kind of probably towards the end. So it's possible that I'll pause on editing it. If there's an announcement first. If not, I'll cut it.
Okay, perfect. That sounds good. So there's that. I'm not really working on it. That's kind of just stuff that happens around me. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. You can find me. There are not that many people with my name.
That is something that we've actually heard a lot from authors, is that once their book is optioned for like a series or a movie, they have nothing to do with it. It's just like, it is in your hands. I've given you my baby and go.
I think it depends. You know, I mean, I think there are authors, like I have friends who are doing the adaptations themselves.
Okay, cool.
And are like, I'm going to write the screenplay, sometimes with another screenplay writer, sometimes on their own. It wasn't something that I was too keen on doing, to be frank. I mean, firstly, it's not my expertise. I would have to learn a whole new genre. I don't know. I've never written a screenplay before. But the other thing is, I already wrote the book once, and it was like, I like poured myself into that book.
Right.
And so I feel like it would, with this, you know, if I were to adapt it, I'd have to write the book again, except this time I'd have to justify it to like 10 different studio executives. And, you know, like, it's like, it sounds torturous to me, actually. Like, I don't think it would be that fun. And then I also think that once I decided that I myself wasn't going to do the adaptation, I was very comfortable. So we have a great showrunner, and I was like, it needs to be her vision. Mm-hmm. You know, like an adaptation is not a photocopy of a book. Like, she has to be able to change details and, you know, bring, you know, it has to become a separate work of art that is driven by her creative vision. And so I think it's best to kind of stay out of it.
Yeah. Because at the end of the day, you left things up for the reader's interpretation.
Yes.
As you wrote this book. So at the same time, like putting it into screen form is her interpretation of the art put out into the world. And you're like, I want to see what you think of it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly. And I was very lucky that I got to choose the team that I'm working with. And I love them. You know, I mean, that was a big part of it, was pick a team that really respects what it is that you did. And, you know, hopefully with that kind of guardrail, they're not going to kind of change the book, you know, into something. And I know they won't, because they're wonderful people. And we do actually talk all the time. I just don't get involved in the actual nuts and bolts.
Well, very cool. Well, we're going to be just anxiously awaiting for this to come out and your next book, because I'm already hooked on
thank you.
The next one. So maybe you'll come back and talk to us about your next book.
I would love to. Yes.
And then Laura will be there next time. Hopefully.
Yes. I'm looking forward to meeting her. We will talk about yoga the next time.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time. We sincerely appreciate you coming on.
It was delightful. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Kirsten.
We're back. I did go see the Super Mario movie and I really liked it, by the way.
I'm so glad. Well, thank you to Kirsten for taking the time to talk to me and
coming on the show. Thank you so much for responding to my Instagram DM.
She slides hard, y'all. She slides.
My sliding game is unmatched. Unmatched. I am a professional DM slider.
No, and I look forward to seeing what she does next. So maybe we'll have her on. Let's sip.
Are you ready for this?
Yes. Guys, that's her non-alcoholic fizzy beverage.
All right. I'm making a pour so you can see this, and I have a coupe glass. Ooh.
Ooh, it's pretty. It's a really pretty rosé, guys.
Wow. All right. So in my cup right now is the Shirley non-alcoholic sparkling rosé made in California. Is it alcohol removed wine? Wow, it actually smells like wine.
And I actually was having a chat with the lady at Seychelles, the non-alcoholic wine store, and non-alcoholic wines are actually can be more expensive than regular wine because of the process to remove the alcohol is quite taxing, apparently.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's delicious. Alcohol removed sparkling rosé definitely tastes like wine. So this is from Shirley. It's definitely very dry. It's missing some of the like sweeter notes of a typical sparkling rosé, but I'm okay with it. So this is from Shirley. Their sparkling rosé is a delightful award-winning rosé with fruit-forward notes of bright peach, passion fruit, and strawberry, delicate body, smooth texture, and pleasing finish. Shirley is non-alcoholic wine for wine lovers. If you need to cut back on drinking or just want something refreshing, you've come to the right place. Shirley is made for wine lovers who don't settle for just good enough. Crafted by a talented team of winemakers, we promise a sophisticated experience that doesn't compromise on taste or your health. Finally, a truly dry sparkling wine. Sourced from the finest vineyards of California, Shirley teams up with the best Sonoma winemakers to deliver a flavorful experience that doesn't force you to decide between taste and health. Shirley Sparkling Rosé is gluten-free, keto, and vegan-friendly. Plus, there's no unnecessary addition of sugar, just a tiny quantity of sulfites, making it an excellent choice for a healthy, fun-filled, hangover-free celebration. On the very first sip, you'll taste a delightful rose with fruit-forward notes of passion fruit, bright peach, and strawberry. As you close your eyes and think hard, you'll get a hint of juicy melon, imparting a distinct tropical note. Make no mistake, this sparkling wine is dry, very little sweetness. I concur. Its refreshing and high acidity levels swirl around your mouth during the first sips and then stay to give a delicate, smooth texture and pleasing finish. When you pour the Shirley Sparkling Rosé into a glass, it gives a visual impression of champagne. The bubbles automatically scream celebration. The ingredients are de-alcoholized California rosé wine, pear juice, passion fruit juice, guava puree, and organic cane sugar. So there you go. And that is the Shirley non-alcoholic sparkling rosé.
Well, heck yeah. I'm glad you found one that's good, because if you think about like sparkling ciders and things like that, the champagnes are usually just so nasty. I went to a wedding and the mother of the bride didn't drink, but she was like, I am not drinking that. I'm going to have a glass of real champagne to celebrate because this tastes like crap.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the non-alcoholic wines are really gross. I've had the Free. It's like F-R-E with like the straight line on top.
Mm-hmm.
I've had their Prosecco, and the Prosecco is good, but their Merlot, or was it a Cab Sav? It was one of their red wines, was gross. It was like, it tasted like spoiled Welch's.
Mm, no.
Yeah, it was not good. Not good. This is nice.
I'm glad that it's quite red. It was a little bit pinker to start, but I feel like it's darkening up a little bit.
Yeah, it definitely is. But it's very pretty and it looks very festive. And so if you are either cutting back on drinking or just looking for a non-alcoholic wine, this one, and it comes in like cute cans. You can get it in bottles, but you can also get it in cans since it's summertime. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Well, heck yeah. And if you are participating in alcohol, I have something for you. So Kirsten said that her favorite wines, if price was not an option or was not a thing, she would get a Burgundy region red wine. Well, I couldn't find one in our price range, but I found this. It's a Louis Jadot, Beaujolais Villages. And
I've had that. It's so good.
Yep. It's 100% Jamay. Yeah. Jamay grapes. It's an easy drinking wine with grapes of the highest quality from the Beaujolais region of Burgundy. That's why I picked it. Burgundy, as close as I could get.
Good job.
And on the back, the flavor says a plump wine with notes of strawberry, black cherry, and spice. Or pair with hors d'oeuvres, mild cheeses, or poultry dishes. She is 13% ABV. So a little bit of info about the wine from their website. Their additional notes on here say fresh aromas, the strawberries and black cherries, offset by a lively peppery note. And it's aged with semi-carbonic maceration to bring more tannins and structure to the wine. And that's the defining factor of the Louis Jadot style of making the bolder Beaujolais wines. And then if we go to totalwine.com, I got mine at Trader Joe's.
TJ's.
Yep. You know, I love TJ's. The total wine price is $11.79. I think it was $11.99
at
Trader Joe's. So really reasonably priced, there, but total wine recommends pairing with grilled white meat. They say that that's the best for it. And about the varietal, where is that note? This website does not participate when you click on the link at the pop downs. The red.
She's researching in real time.
Well, I already.
Look at her go.
I had it, but they close up every single time you go to a different one.
Oh, lame.
Yeah. So you can't like keep them all open. Ooh. Anyway, I did my research, guys. The red Jamay grape makes this light refreshing wines of the Beaujolais regions. The wines range from juicy, quaffable Beaujolais Nouveau the first wine to be released from each year's harvest to the Beaujolais villages, wines from 38 notable towns in Beaujolais to Cru Beaujolais, the most complex wines from 10 towns that carry the Cru classification. All Gamay wines are generally fresh and lively, filled with bright fruit flavors and perfumed aromas. They are meant to be enjoyed young and often benefit from a slight chill, making them a great option for warm weather red wine.
There we go.
And the real woohoo of this wine is that this is the wine that Bill and Frank drink in the Last of Us episode.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
And that's amazing.
Yeah. And so if you read all of the reviews, it says, tastes great. Goes with savory chicken dishes and our own turkey chili. Hell, Frank and Bill loved it with wild caught rabbit.
I love that.
I bought this to drink while watching episode 3 of The Last of Us. I'm a fan of both now. Cheers to Bill and Frank.
Cheers to Bill and Frank.
Perfect when you haven't eaten anything for 2 days. Got served this wine alongside some rabbit and it was delicious. The guy who knew to pair the rabbit with this wine seemed like he knew his stuff. Had to get one for the house and bought one. Loved it. Will be a mainstay from now on. And then one of my other personal favorite reviews is this wine pairs perfect with my PlayStation.
Nice.
So
love that.
Really good, really simple, cheap wine that you can get Trader Joe's, Total Wine. Sure, you can get it from the grocery store too.
And that brand in general, like the Louis Jadot, is a really, really good brand.
Mm-hmm. So just knowing that you're gonna maybe have a party and you need to just grab some wines at $12 a bottle, I think all of your guests would be really happy with that being their kind of red wine of choice.
Yeah. And then I got a hint from a wine seller at some point where if it's a red wine that just needs to be quote unquote slightly chilled, put it in the fridge for like 30 minutes and then take it out. And there you go. Slightly chilled. And that's what we got.
Yeah. When we talked to the authors, we kind of like beat the topic to death. And so I don't really have any questions for you, Laura. I wish I had more to discuss with you. Maybe we'll have to pick a book that like is just.
Well, I feel like our read caps are the ones where we really like dive in together and like just go through because we don't interview authors on those episodes. So.
Yeah. But yeah. Really love this book. Good pick.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It was fantastic. I loved this book. I read it over spring break. So I read it all the way in March. So now it's May. It's been a minute, but just loved that book entirely. So yeah, that's what we got. Andy Bart's book, Andrea Bart's Spare Room, comes out in June. So go ahead, you can already pre-order it on Barnes & Noble. You can pre-order it with your local booksellers. You can pre-order it on Amazon. So go ahead, pre-order it. We will be talking to her. We actually talked to her tomorrow, but y'all will get to hear all about that next month.
And the episode is going to release on the book date, the book release date. So once you get the book and you read it, you can immediately hear what we have to say about it, what Andy has to say about it. And so really excited about that.
Oh, we've never done that before. So whoop, whoop. Thank you, Andy. Yeah.
Bottoms up.
Stay weird.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Decanterbury Tales, a boozy book club podcast. If you've loved what you listened to, don't forget to write us a review. It is the best way to share the love. Enjoy our website, decanterburytales.com. Write us an email at decanterburypod@gmail.com. Check us out on Instagram at decanterburypod, Facebook, Decanterbury Tales, the podcast, and on Goodreads, Decanterbury Tales. Bottoms up and stay weird. Cheers!